Hi, I'm Adam Ellis.
And this is Phil Wilson, and welcome back to Post-Restorationist Radio.
It's been been a little bit longer than we meant for it to, but schedules being what they are, we're finally getting to it, and we're happy about that.
Yes, we are. And we might as well go ahead and get our obligatory Brian McLaren reference in, because you actually got to talk to the man himself last week.
I did, yeah. That actually seems like a long time ago now. But yeah, I went to a retreat with about 40 people in Maryland, and Brian was there. He was just extremely accessible. He slept in a bunkhouse where we were at, and it was just really neat. Had several conversations with him. I wouldn't expect him to remember me, but for me that was a big deal. Had two or three actual just me and him conversations, and actually recorded most of the sessions. I had to leave early for a funeral on Wednesday, so I missed the last one. But I recorded most of the sessions and posted them up over on my other podcast if people are interested in that. Phil, you actually listened to them. How did that come across?
They were very interesting. I thought that the McLaren ones were both really intriguing, and it was kind of a little view into the life of the of ministers, especially coming from me as a layperson, for lack of a better term. And I thought the one by Keith Matthews. I thought that one was interesting too. Again, just to hear about kind of the thoughts that ministers have as they try to minister to their congregations, as they try to work with their congregations. Particularly, I thought it was really interesting to hear from female ministers, mm-hmm. Female clergy, and their perspective on a lot of the issues that go into it. Because I know from our perspective, from the Church of Christ perspective, we generally think of ministers strictly as men. But there certainly is a different dynamic that a woman can bring to a position of ministry.
Yeah, it was an interesting interaction, and the way that we did the recording, you actually do pick up most of the comments and questions that come out, and they're from a wide variety of backgrounds. You had everything from Methodist church plants to female pastors of a Congregationalist mainline congregation to three Church of Christ guys in the room. So it was an interesting interchange. Keith Matthews, now that you mention him, was a very pleasant surprise. I wasn't familiar with him previously. I used to be on staff with Brian at Cedar Ridge.
Right.
Now he teaches over at Azusa Pacific. I think Dallas Willard is his personal mentor, and he actually wrote the companion guide to Divine Conspiracy. Brilliant guy. Just such a really pleasant surprise. I got to talk to him a good bit, too. Just nothing but respect for the guy.
Right. Well, and you know, like Adam said, I would definitely encourage people to go over to the Join the Revolution podcast and take a listen to those. And you know, I think there's some really valuable stuff that, you know, like I said, both ministers and non-paid ministers.
Yeah. Like the second one that I have from McLaren actually I think would be interesting to a lot of people, because on the first one he dealt with spiritual formation, which was obviously good stuff. In the second one, he just did a general Q&A, and so he actually just responded to questions lobbed at him from the crowd. And he deals with things like he deals with the atonement, he deals with inclusion and exclusion, just all kind of subjects. That was really interesting to me, and really interesting that he would even do that.
Right. Well, what we would like to talk about tonight is a subject that we kind of dealt with at the end of the last podcast, the Why People Leave the Churches of Christ podcast. And it was this idea that Adam brought up about maintenance versus mission. And it's an idea that has really stuck with me a lot over the course of the last, I guess now, almost 3 weeks. But it's something that I think deserves to be talked about a little bit more. And again, you know, we're coming from a couple of different perspectives, of Adam being a minister within the Churches of Christ, a paid minister within the Churches of Christ, and me kind of more as a lay person. But just I think it's a subject that we really can get into and really can sink our teeth into. So Adam, do you want to recap a little bit about what you talked about, and then we can jump right into it?
Okay, I've got this theory that basically, on one hand, you as a Christian and you as a church or congregation or whatever, you can pursue maintenance, which is the idea of keeping things the way that they are and keeping people, just keeping people happy and that kind of thing, sort of, you know, self-defining term. Or you have the idea of mission. And a lot of people want to say, when they hear me say that, they want to say, well, of course we pursue both of those. And I guess that's true to a certain extent, but one is always going to be the slave of the other. So you can be maintenance oriented, and then you may get little whims of mission every once in a while, but they're always a slave to the idea of maintaining what you already have. And to be totally honest with you, the mission tends to fizzle out, because really pursuing mission is going to challenge a lot of the things that you're trying to maintain. On the other hand, if organizationally you're pursuing mission, then you're going to have affinity for your traditions, but you're going to hold them loosely, and you're going to understand that the more important thing is what you're actually here to do rather than maintain. And just to sort of add to it, and I don't know where this will go, I think that where you fall down on that actually can even be traced back to what you believe was going on at creation in Genesis 1 and 2. Because there's a lot of people who see the Garden of Eden as sort of this perfect static thing, and they see that man's role was, number one, not to touch it because you're going to mess it up, but his job was just to maintain the perfection that was there. And then in Genesis 3, they believe that it gets all screwed up because he messes it up and doesn't maintain it. And so they see the church as something that God created that was perfect in the first century that we see being set up in Acts, and our job then is just to maintain it in its forms and in its structure, and just kind of hold on to it and keep it from getting corrupted like the world did. On the other hand, you have people like me and several others who actually are starting to believe that creation was not perfect in the static, unchanging, don't touch it sense, but is what Genesis 1 and 2 refers to as good, and it's sort of dynamic, and it's loaded with potential, and people are put in the middle of it to bear God's image, and to be creative, and to go somewhere with it, and they've got this mission. Therefore, the forms can be held loosely, because the mission is what's important, and I think that crosses over to church as well.
So kind of the thought that we're working with here, then, is that the idea of maintenance tends to be more inwardly focused, and the idea of mission tends to be more outwardly focused. And again, we're kind of dealing with generalizations here.
Yeah, and that is a very general way to put it, because I would almost say that maintenance isn't even, I mean, it has a people-focused element, because you have sort of your power players that you're just trying to appease because, oh my goodness, what would happen if these people left?
Right.
But even more than that, and even what those power players tend to be trying to do, and I'm speaking in a very general way here, is just maintain the way things have been. And that's sort of the highest goal. Keep them the way that they were. And so in that sense, it's not even about people. It's about the forms themselves and the structure itself.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying there. So, you know, one of the books that I actually just finished reading it a couple of nights ago is a book called The Present Future by Reggie McNeil. And it's subtitled Six Tough Questions for the Church. And I'll actually probably be talking about this on my blog on Monday. But one of the ideas that McNeil brought out is that I think from the maintenance perspective, you look at church almost like a club. Mm-hmm. And as people join the church, they're joining a club. And so what the church ends up doing at that point then is trying to provide reasons for people to stay in the club. You provide a great children's ministry or a great youth right. ministry or a great worship. And I think that's kind of what I was thinking about from a more inwardly focused aspect. And I guess kind of the way that I've thought about maintenance versus mission is that the maintenance is focused more on, you know, the people, maintaining the people within the church
okay,
itself.
Okay, yeah, it could actually be, I mean, it can actually go a couple of different ways. I think in Churches of Christ it tends to be about the forms and blah, blah, blah in some areas, but I can also see there's a very and this is even true in the more progressive end of things, and I think that might be why it speaks to you more, because you've lived, you know, you've said in earlier shows that that's the world that you've sort of lived in most of your life.
Yes.
The danger and temptation there is to get caught up in the idea of just simply numbers and maintaining your own success. I talk sometimes and write sometimes about a congregation doing something for the glory of the congregation.
Yeah.
And just sort of maintaining their membership, maintaining their programs, maintaining their budget, and even growing those things, but just for their own sake. I mean, is that kind of what you're pointing at when you talk about maintenance?
Yeah, it is, and in fact, that's an idea. I'm going to be teaching a class in on the kingdom this summer at church, and I'm going back and rereading Lee Camp's Mere Discipleship. And one of the ideas that Lee brings out in the book is that the church itself can become a principality or a power in the lives of people, in that it becomes the controlling force rather than the mission that the people are supposed to be on.
That's interesting.
I think the power, I guess, for lack of a better term, of what the church does becomes much stronger within the setting of the people, and so they focus so much more on maintaining, like what we've talked about already, maintaining the traditions and maintaining the ideas that were the founding principles of the church, as opposed to being a little bit more flexible. And you know, that's something that, you know, we've experienced somewhat at Otter Creek with the move that we've made here in the last 6 months. People are very on edge about new things being done and can get a little bit uptight if something doesn't go particularly in a way that they would necessarily think it should go.
And that's because the identity, what they perceive as the identity of the church, is threatened because you're in a new location, so they have to keep a hold on the things that they perceive make them themselves.
Exactly.
And that's an interesting thing to bring up, because I see, even at Grand Central, where I am now, there's this thing that's almost palpable, and nobody really voices it. But they worry, you know, we've got a Christian university here, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, this isn't an official position. I don't even think this is on the radar of leadership. They're not thinking this way or making their decisions this way. But among just sort of the common folks corporately, there seems to be the sense of, we can't get too close to the college or we'll lose our identity as Grand Central.
Really?
And that just, you know, as an outsider coming in, astounds me. Because I look around and I think, is this building your identity? Is the way that your service is structured on Sunday morning, is that your identity? Because that doesn't seem to be an identity. That doesn't seem to be what should be forming the identity of a body of believers to me. You know, these things, now they're important. I don't want to diminish them, and I certainly don't. I understand and recognize that I don't have the same history, and this is true of anywhere I go.
Right.
I don't have the same history that these people who have been there since day one have. I don't have a sense for it. I can't even fake the kind of respect they have for it. You know, I just can't muster that, because I wasn't there.
Yes.
And so I do try to be sensitive to that. But at the same time, I want to say, is that your identity? Or is your identity what you're actually trying to function and do? And that's a very tough call. I mean, it's a very tough call.
It is, and I think that especially we within the Churches of Christ can get very caught up in brand loyalty, for lack of a better term. And I think that kind of comes from the mindset, again, you and I weren't alive during this time, but the real strong period of growth that Churches of Christ had in the 50s and 60s. Where you got this real strong, I get this sense from reading, you know, reading different histories and listening to different people talk about what happened back then, is that it was a great period of growth, because people were able to go to other people and convince them to leave, you know, Baptist or Methodist or whatever, and become a non-denominational Church of Christ person.
Right.
And it did become a lot about brand loyalty. And so we get this real strong tie to who we are as the Church of Christ. And I think in a lot of ways, that kind of, as you've said, that maintenance of those traditions, that maintenance of that mindset can really hinder us in a lot of ways from what I think you and I both see is truly the mission of the church, which is to create disciples of Jesus.
Yeah, and I would even go beyond, that. It may very well be a different way of saying the same thing. But I believe that the church exists as a catalyst for the kingdom of God.
Yeah.
I think N.T. Wright refers to it as the places where heaven and earth overlap. Mm-hmm. And we try to make it overlap and interlock, and we try to make that true more and more. That does absolutely involve making more disciples. And on another time, we're going to have to, I was thinking about this before we started, we're going to have to deal with the actual subject of evangelism and conversion. That's something that I want us to talk about at some point. Because that absolutely plays into this. What do we convert people to? And what does that mean for the church after that? So I wonder, I really, really wonder sometimes, how, if we could convert people, bring them on board with a mission instead of just converting to some kind of afterlife. But that's a subject for another time, you know.
Yeah. Well, it is, but I think it also deals with what is attractive or attractional to people as they look at a church. And even in saying that, that can almost make it sound like it's some kind of marketing thing where you're trying to market to people or whatever.
Well, and there are some people who mean exactly that.
Yes, that's true. And one of the things that I've kind of decided is, I think a church has to be what it is, and hopefully people will buy into whatever that church is doing. For instance, we do the contemplative Vesper service at Otter Creek on Wednesday nights.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we discussed at the outset of it was, well, you know, how can we attract, you know, younger people to the, to the service, and how, you know, what kind of things can we do to make it real attractive to, you know, to people. And one of the things that I kind of said at the outset of it was, look, I don't know that we necessarily need to worry about that. What we need to do is stuff that we find meaningful to us, and if it's meaningful to other people as well, then they'll come.
Right. There's a real sense. And okay, you brought this up a minute ago. I think it ties in absolutely to what you're saying. You talked about in the period of the 50s and 60s where what we were doing was apparently really, really effective in the Churches of Christ. And I think there's some cultural reasons for that. Now, when I'm describing it, I say it was evangelism where I basically sit you down and I argue with you. And when you finally realize and admit that you were stupid and I was smart and I was right, then you're converted. And it's, you know, that's a very harsh way to put it, but that was extremely effective at the time, culturally, because it was about being right, and that was the most important thing. It was even more important than it being good. And so we focused really, really hard on being right. And I talk a lot about being true to our heritage, and I mean that in the broad story sense of what the church was always meant to be. And I also mean that very particularly within the Stone Campbell Restoration movement. You mentioned before about Alexander Campbell walking around with a copy of the Bible and a copy of John Locke's stuff in his hand.
Yes.
And you know, a lot of people say that with a very sort of disdainful tone in their voice when they mention it. To me, I think that's actually very cool. I think it speaks very highly of Campbell if you understand what he was doing. Campbell was absolutely engaging the culture that he was in with the gospel. And I don't think, to be true to that heritage, what we need to do is maintain exactly his approach. Matter of fact, he didn't. I mean, he was, if you study his life, he was always evolving and thinking and wrestling with this stuff. And what happens is, after that sort of charismatic leader dies, people tend to crystallize their beliefs at a certain point, or even caricature them, and then shift into maintenance mode and just maintain them and lock in. And I think what would actually be more true to that heritage is if we figured out ways to engage our culture now. Now that's more complicated than it sounds, because that can also that can sound like just what you were saying. What are the teenagers going to like? What are the college kids going to like? And let's do that. That's not actually true, because number one, what they want to see is something that's actually good before they care if it's right. They want to know that it's actually good and that it's good for people whether they ever buy your ideas or not. Are you good for the world around you, whether they ever agree with you or not? And number two, they want something that's authentic. Sort of the in marketing, since we brought that up, the catchphrase now is, don't let your marketing show. And, I mean, the church can learn something like that, where everybody's lagging behind on that. And I'm not saying, so we need to be hip with the new marketing stuff. I'm saying you need to understand the marketing stuff shoots yourself in the foot now, because they don't want a product. They want something that's real, and they want something that's good. And so I'm right on board with you. I think what actually, interestingly enough, is going to engage this culture is if we are actually good and if we're doing things that are authentic and true to who we are. That, I think, interestingly enough, it draws people now.
Yeah, and I think that's where, as, again, to use the term that I was using before, as brand loyalty kind of dies out, it's what you do that people are becoming more and more interested in. I think, and I'm the same way myself, in that I'm not interested necessarily in what people say. That does interest me, but I don't think that's the most important thing. I'm much more interested in what people do.
Right.
In how they are effectively trying to accomplish the mission, and how they're really trying to do that. Now, the great quandary that comes out of that is, you know, how do you, for lack of a better term, advertise to the church the things that the church is doing without it sounding self-aggrandizing, or, you know, the other example that I've heard before is, how appropriate is it to bring somebody up on stage to talk about how humble they are?
I was talking to somebody about that today, actually. You know, here's where I think we've got to do a reboot, and this is a very systemic thing, and, you know, I'm going to say it like it's an easy thing to do, and it's not. I talk all the time now about I want what we do in youth ministry to be less a ministry to youth and more a ministry of youth.
Yeah, and I think that's a great philosophy to have.
And I think that we've got to sort of reboot our ministries all like that. And we're very locked in. And since we tend to lag behind the broader evangelical world in this, we're we haven't quite caught up to some of the things that they're starting to realize, although some of them still have no sense of it, is they think that what we're supposed to do is market the brightest, shiniest religious goods and services. I mean, it's kind of what you were talking about before. And so we still feel like we got to get up there and show how ours is the better, is the best and the brightest, and how it's better than the competitions. And I think what really people want, and what beyond what they want, I think what they're wired to need, is a place where they feel like they can be making a difference. Now, they'll very quickly fall into the consumer mindset, but I think there's this yearning inside just about everybody that wants to find a place where they can plug in and make their life matter, make it count, make a difference, and be a part of something bigger than themselves that's making a difference. That's a tough sell, though.
It is, and that's where I think I disagree a little bit with what you said at the very outset of this talk, in that I think a church has to be about both maintenance and mission. Now, I think that's an incredibly difficult balance to strike, because I do think people, this is just my impression because I'm this way myself, that people are pretty selfish by nature.
Right.
And that they tend to look out more for what's going to be good for them, and the what's going to be good for other people can necessarily kind of be pushed off to the side. But I think what churches have to be about is dealing with the people that come to the church and help either help them become disciples, period, or help them continue in their growth as disciples, as well as looking out at the mission that the church is supposed to be about and helping other people experience the kingdom of God, helping other people grow or even just get introduced to the idea of being a follower of Jesus.
Yeah, and this is where you and I, and this will be a new interesting dynamic for the show. This may be where you and I actually do disagree on something. Because to me, and this is how this plays out, I actually do believe that one is always the slave to the other, and one will okay. always defeat the other, and you cannot approach them with the same force or emphasis. One is always going to fall victim to the other. What personally makes me think that we're sort of in a deadlock where we never actually get anywhere is because the whole way that we bring people in is wrong. What we bring them okay. into is wrong. And when we yeah. say, hey, look at our pretty, and I know this isn't what you're advocating, but when we say, hey, look at all our pretty goods and services, look at what we've got for your kids, and look at what we got for da-da-da, and people come into that, and they come for the bells and whistles, and they come for all the stuff that we're offering to them, and then eventually we pull sort of this bait-and-switch thing around, oh, no, now you need to help the world. Well, that's not right. what we converted them to. We converted them to saying, oh, it really is about you. Oh, no, wait, it's not. And nobody can make the conversion. They're like, but it was about me. And that's they're being honest, because that's what we use to get them in. And I think that's always going to be a problem. Now, at the same time, I think that you look at Jesus in the Bible, and I think that you look at the early church, and you see that Jesus does. I mean, it's incredible who he reaches out to. And the depths and the lengths that he's willing to go to let people know that he cares about them and that he loves them and that it'll help them and it'll help the kingdom of God to break through in their life. But when it gets going, when it comes down to who's really with him, when he lays something out there and people sort of balk at it, Jesus' response is, well, sorry. If you need to go, if you can't go along with that, then bye. Because we're going this way. And then he tends to look at the other disciples and says, hey, guys, are you going too? Because there's the door. Because I'm not changing where we're going with this thing.
Well, and I agree with that. And I honestly don't, I don't think we agree as far as that part, or I don't think we disagree as far as that part of it goes. And I think churches should be very upfront about dying to self. And that as people come to the church, that you're not calling people into, you know, a YMCA that has, you know, songs on Sunday morning.
Right.
You know, stuff like that. But I do think that there are aspects of what a church should do that should be formative for the members of the church. And I say that, and I almost cringe at hearing myself say that. So I don't think that's what I mean.
No. I'm with you there, because I think there are things that should be formative. I think there should be things that are causing... it's like McLaren and Keith were talking about at that retreat where they're talking about spiritual formation. We should be doing things that are causing causing Christ to be formed inside of people. And I think that involves things like worship. I think they can even involve things like, and this word makes me cringe, programs. Okay, I think that, but we're very intentional about them, and even then, we're forming the image of Christ in people for the sake of the world around them. You understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And so that still is an aspect, but do you see how it's still, at least in my mind, that's still a slave to mission? Because if the image of Christ is truly formed in you, then that's going to move you towards mission, because that's what Jesus does. He makes you less self-centered and more focused on God and the world.
Okay, so what you're not saying that...
No, I'm not... Yeah, I'm not saying just forget about the church people and just, you know, pour everything outside.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that, but I'm saying it should always lead to less focus on yourself. There's no sense. When we're in... I think Dallas Willard says something like this in Divine Conspiracy. If what we're doing in discipleship is producing people who are somehow more self-centered, more egocentric, more selfish than they were before they came to Jesus, then we are doing something horribly, horribly wrong.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So what it seems like you're saying, though, is that the idea of maintenance, that maintenance is not a bad thing in and of itself, but if it's done within the overall context of mission... And what it sounds like you're saying is that mission, if done, if even done with a maintenance-oriented church, is just done within the context of maintenance. That the two are not necessarily mutually exclusive, but one is,
serves the other.
Yeah, okay.
One always serves the other. And if you try, sort of my main point in this is if you try to say we're going to hold them equally, we're going to pursue them both equally, and there are lots of people who disagree with me on this, but if you try to hold both of them equally, you are going to wind up serving maintenance, and mission is going to become the obedient servant of maintenance, and you're just honestly not going to get very far.
Okay. I can agree with that. So, okay, let's get practical here in the last couple of minutes.
No, I don't do practical.
Oh, okay, sorry. you're just the one that sees the problem and comes up with a dream.
Yeah, I just took 1 year of counseling, so I just identify problems and do nothing to solve them. No, basically, this is where it's tough. I mean, if you're talking about a church plant, they can do that tomorrow, okay? Because they're not dealing with the baggage. When you're talking about established churches, I have to believe that that's possible. Just because I have such a love for them, and just because I can't see God just abandoning all these, you know, that's a weird image, but God just saying, okay, well, I can't work through established churches, so every generation or so we're going to scrap all the old churches and start a bunch of new ones. I just can't, I know people who do buy that, I just can't buy it. But it's going to take this radical rethinking of everything down to how we bring people into Christianity to start with, because I think that initial concept, that first impression of what this is all about, is incredible. If you get that wrong, it's incredibly difficult to overcome, because that's sort of your foundation, to use that kind of language, and anything you build sort of has to be able to sit on top of that. And if you were brought in saying, hey, it's all about an afterlife, it's all about you taking care of your own tail so that one day you can wind up in heaven and not hell, then you're going to wind up with a maintenance-oriented church. There's not a lot of security in that, and you were taught, no matter what's said later, you were taught, this is all about you. This is all about you as an individual, this is all about you corporately as Christians, and you very quickly become the self-serving country club because of the way that you were brought in. Now, if we can deal with that problem, then we can start dealing with sort of restructuring, and we can do this anyway, restructuring and being very intentional about the thing, the quote maintenance things that we're doing, and making them serve a mission mindset. But it's intentionality all the way from step one, as far as I can see it.
Okay, so how do we do that with an existing churches then?
Still figuring that one out, my friend. I would love to hear anybody's suggestion. I mean, the thing that I've decided to do for myself, and sort of explains my career, is I think that that's very easy to do with teenagers. Okay, with adults, and I include myself in this, we tend to be very stubborn. We tend to be very defensive. And when somebody threatens our previously held worldview, we will fight tooth and nail. We really don't want to reconsider any of it. But with teenagers, you are forming their initial worldview. You are forming their initial concepts. And so it's a much slower process than I would like it to be. But for me, that's how I see that playing out. You start with kids who are young, and that's how you sort of change the face of things.
Okay, so what you're saying is get the kids, but you're not sure how to get the adults.
Well, you know, John Mark Hicks said something really interesting, and I approach this from the youth ministries aspect, obviously, because that's my job. That's where all my attention and focus goes, and obviously I believe in that. John Mark Hicks, when I asked him a similar question last fall, he said something about that he still had this belief that with most of our people in the churches of Christ, if you can actually show them in the Word of God how this plays out, that he just has to believe that the majority of them will go with you. If you can actually show it to them in Scripture and show them how it plays out, then they can go there. Now, my role with kids, I see that happen all the time. It's just, quite frankly, not my role to work with many adults on that yet. Although, I will say, last Saturday I did a class sort of on faith development, how faith develops, that kind of thing. I did it for adults at sort of a junior youth rally we did. I did a class for the adults and ran it twice. And they, when we were walking through that, they responded to that, to some of these ideas really, really well. I actually recorded that too, and you can even hear some of their reaction to it. And so I am hopeful, particularly with them. I was talking about developing faith in your kids and these kids that you care about, and how that works and your response to it and how you can nurture it and that kind of thing. And they were very, I mean, showing it to them biblically, showing it to them how it worked out, even talking about our heritage and tradition somewhat, they really got excited about the things that we're talking about. So, you know, somebody's got to sit there and tell them, and it's going to be a slow process, and you have to be very intentional about it, and you're going to have to be willing to deal with the flack for with people who just can't go there for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Talking about maintenance and mission, though, I feel like we have to bring up, and I thought about it halfway through this, your minister, Tim Woodruff, in his book, Church That Flies, that the metaphor that he uses about flight, where he talks about birds and then the airplane,
yes.
And then he talks about this, I forget what the word is, but where people tried to make these flying machines that worked actually like the bird functions, and
yeah.
None of them ever worked. It was some long word that
right.
starts with an O. And then he actually talks about, but when they build a plane, they actually pay attention to the dynamic principles of flight and find something that doesn't actually function very much like a bird at all. Its form isn't much like a bird at all, but it uses the principles, the dynamic principles that actually make it able to fly. That, I
right.
think, is a brilliant way. And I'm so thankful to him for that analogy, because that's how this plays out in my mind.
Yeah.
We can expend a lot of energy just focusing on maintaining those forms and maintaining what we've previously seen, or we can pay attention to the dynamic principles, which I would even go as far as to say that's the mission, God's intention of why you're here and why you're a body of believers. And then we're going to start to take different shapes. We're going to start to take different forms, but that may be what enables us to fly. That's kind of how it plays out for me.
Yeah, I agree. I think the metaphor that Tim came up with for that is really extraordinary, and it's really insightful into this conversation. I think was really prescient in seeing some of the developments that are happening, not just within Churches of Christ, but within churches as a whole. So you're right. I'm thankful to him for that as well. Well, you got any final thoughts you want to toss out before we close it out for the night?
I know that we've got a lot more to unpack, especially when I talk about going back to square one and evangelism, and so I think pretty soon we're going to wind up talking about that.
Yeah, I agree.
That should prove to be an interesting discussion.
I agree. I think we'll probably end up, you know, either as a part of that or directly after that, we'll probably have to end up talking about salvation and exactly what that looks like
right.
a little bit more, too.
Right.
So, all right, well, great thoughts tonight.
Enjoyed it.
Maybe one day we'll get this figured out.
Maybe one day we'll come up with an actual schedule when we record things and people know when to listen.
No, let's not get crazy now. All right. Well, for the Post Restorationist Radio podcast, this is Phil Wilson.
And I'm Adam Ellis.
Thanks a lot.
Talk to you later.